Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Yaha,
which,
asau,
that,
twaya,
by you,
kara
sarocha,
with the lotus palm,
hataha,
struck,
patangaha,
the ball,
dikshu,
in all directions,
Brahman,
moving,
Brahmataha,
restless,
Ejayate,
disturbs,
Akshini,
eyes,
May,
of me,
Muktam,
scattered,
Na,
not.
Te,
your.
Smarasi,
are you mindful of?
Vakra,
curling.
Jata,
of hair.
Varutam,
bunches.
Kastaha,
giving trouble.
Anilaha,
wind.
Harati,
takes away.
Lampataha,
like a man attached to women.
Ishaha,
this.
Nivim,
lower garment.
Translation,
my mind is already restless, and by playing with a ball, moving it all about with your lotus-like palm, you are also agitating my eyes. Your curling black hair is now scattered, but you are not attentive to arranging it. Are you not going to arrange it? Like a man attached to women, the most cunning wind is trying to take off your lower garment. Are you not mindful of it? So, purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. The girl, Purvachitti, was playing with a ball in her hand, and the ball seemed like nothing but another lotus flower captured by her lotus-like palm. Because of her movements, her hair was loose, and the belt holding her cloth was giving way, as if the cunning wind were trying to make her naked. Yet she paid no attention to arranging her hair or fixing her dress. So Agnidra tried to see the girl's naked beauty, his eyes were very agitated by her movements. So,
yo sau vaitvaya karasaroja hata patango dikshu brahman brahmatak eja yatekshani me muktam nate smarasi vakrajata varutam kashto nilo harati lampatak eja nivim.
So, Om Ganati Vandasha Gananjana Shlakaya Chakshur and Benitam Yena Tosmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So we should remember here that this King Agnidra was not just like some ordinary human being. He was a very elevated soul. The son of Priyavrata. So he's not just like someone wandering in the streets here in the city, or some bum or something like that, or, you know, some... Anyway, you understand. So even so, because of his position, he was agitated by the going-ons of Purvachitti. And so we find many instances in the Vedic literatures where very elevated persons get agitated for some reason or other. Even we have Lord Brahma at the beginning of the creation. He's chasing his daughter, Vak, I mean, that is a very heavy story. And of course, to rectify his mentality, he had to give up that particular body. That means that mental proclivity he had to give up. And then, of course, we have Lord Shiva. Of course, he was not disturbed by an ordinary girl. He was disturbed by the Mohini Murti incarnation of the Lord. That's a very similar story. That Mohini Murti was playing with a ball in the same way. And Lord Shiva became so disturbed, he started chasing her, running around the world, and so many things happened as a result of that that we're not going to describe in class. And then we have so many great personalities who became disturbed. You have, of course, Bilba Mangal Thakur. There's that famous story of Bilba Mangal Thakur, who became very renounced when he heard from his girlfriend that he should not be so attached, or if he was attached to Krishna in the same way as he was to her, he would be a pure devotee. So he just like gave everything up. But even after he gave everything up, he was visiting the house of a Brahmin, and he became attached to the Brahmin's wife. And he said to the Brahmin, you know, please let me be alone with your wife for a little while. And the Brahmin thought, well, it's my duty just to go along with what a great soul, great renunciate says. And so he allowed that. And Bilba Mangal, being repentant about his desires, asked for the girl's hairpins, and he put out his eyes. So I'm not suggesting that as an alternative, that you put out your eyes in order to become detached from the material world. It doesn't really work like that. But he was a special case, and of course later on Krishna personally took his hand, and when Krishna tried to pull his hand away from Bilba Mangal Thakur, Bilba Mangal Thakur said, you may be able to pull your hand away, but you can't take yourself out of my heart. So this is a great personality. So we have so many stories like this, and the question is, you know, we're not great personalities like this. You know, I'm not as great as Agnidra. I'm not even as great as Hiranyakashipu or Ravana. I mean, these are great personalities, very educated personalities. I mean, Ravana, you know, we hear all these stories about Ravana, you know, Rakshasa and everything. Of course, he was a Rakshasa. His prasadam was human beings, the man-eater. But still, he was so educated that when the demigods, they wanted to perform some sacrifice, they would call for Ravana to help them pronounce the mantras. Because Ravana was born in a Brahmin, actually a Brahmin family, mixed family, Brahmin-Rakshasa family. It's an interesting story. I guess we can tell that in class, because that actually relates to this whole story of people getting their minds disturbed even when they have good intentions and are educated. Because Ravana's father was Vishravas. He was a very dedicated Brahmin. I mean, completely detached, and he had a good wife. And he had a very nice son before he had Ravana as his son. His son's name was Kuvera. It's nice to have a son, Kuvera, who has money, isn't it? Nowadays, the sons, they try their best to take care of their parents, but they don't have much money. And they have to use their parents' money to take care of them. So, in any case, so Vishravas, his son was Kuvera, had a very, very nice wife. At the same time, the demons, they were very upset because they had been defeated by the demigods. And the demigods had gotten this nectar, the amrit, by which they can remain more or less immortal. Not immortal in a real sense, but live a long time, never get sick, never die, etc. like that. So these demigods, they become more powerful. So the demons had a plan. And they thought, we want to create a very powerful demon. And the only way that we can get a powerful demon is if we get a Brahma Rakshasa. Because Brahma Rakshasas are more powerful than ordinary Rakshasas. You hear about that sometimes. Devotees sometimes say, well, I'm being haunted by a Brahma Rakshasa at night. Not usually. It's usually just their own psychology. In any case, so they called for all the nice Rakshasini girls. And one of them said, you know, I'll lure him. And we're going to have a nice Rakshasa son. So anyway, so what she did is she went to Vishravas, who was sitting there meditating, minding his own brahminical business. And she said, hi. You know, like, I'm a sannyasi, I don't know these things. You know, anyway, hi, how are you? High five, you know, whatever she did. She said, I'd like to be married to you. And he said, well, I already have a wife, you know, I'm a Brahmin, and everything like that. And she just, whatever she did, I don't know. She lured him, and somehow or other they got married, and they had a nice little Ravana as a son. And of course, Kumbhakarna, and they had one good son, Vibhishan, who was a devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And they had one daughter who was kind of challenged. Her name was Sirpanaka. This is a Ramayan story. Anyway, so even though he was very alert, a Brahmin, then he somehow or other accepted this Rakshasa wife and gave birth to a Rakshasa son. And all of the brahmacharis left his ashram. It'd be like if you had a temple president, you know, very nice temple president, all of a sudden he marries this demon girl. Actually, that happened in ISKCON. Not here in Slovenia. But it happened, I won't mention exactly the story, but there was a temple president, and he was very austere, dedicated. Even the devotees said that, oh, he must be an incarnation of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. There was this whole rumor going around that he was an incarnation. And then this lady came to the temple, and she wasn't even attractive. She was quite ugly. But she told him that she was the heiress. That means that someone who inherits the Toyota. She said her name was Teshi Toyota. That's an interesting name. And you all know Toyota cars. You've heard of them before. And so she told the temple president that, and he thought, well, I should preach to her. So anyway, so he kept preaching to her behind closed doors, and one thing led to another, and he was married to her. And the devotees were thinking, oh, he sacrificed his sannyas for a higher purpose to get money. So, and, you know, Prabhupada went along with it because, and Prabhupada didn't like it, but Prabhupada, you know, many times he allowed things that technically shouldn't be allowed just so the devotee wouldn't be disobeying his instructions. You know, many times, sometimes a servant would say, how could you allow this person to get divorced? And Prabhupada said he was going to do it anyway. So if I hadn't allowed it, he was going to do it and it would be disobeying me. So Prabhupada really adjusted things just so the devotees wouldn't commit a mad element offense against him. So in this particular case, yeah, the person got married. And what happened is that so many horrible things happened in the temple. They even were offering unofferable things like egg rolls to the deities in New York. I mean, oh, sorry, I shouldn't have mentioned the place. But anyway, it's ISKCON history. I mean, it's on the internet. You can hear about it. You know, there's no need to. So the point I'm making is even this devotee, and he's a very good devotee, he got bewildered by such a circumstance. So what are we going to do? My question is, what are we going to do? And I'm not only talking about the men getting bewildered, women get bewildered too, don't they? No, they don't. They're transcendental. So like Prabhupada said, for men, women are the women, and for women, men are the women. Think about that for a second. It's not that the men are doing a sex change or anything like that, but it, you know, but it's for the same thing, you know, the bewildering factor. And Prabhupada also sometimes said, you know, men are good, women are good, combination, well, a little challenge there. So what do you do about such a circumstance? I mean, do we follow the principles enunciated in certain religions where the women have to wear these burqas. You know what a burqa is? Actually, they're quite romantic because you think that something underneath there must be very beautiful. And you pull off the top and there's... you know, some Rakshasini or something like that. is that the solution? Or as I mentioned in a previous class, in the religion I was born in, they had the women in separate rooms with a curtain there, like that. And basically it was a Middle Eastern religion. It wasn't the Muslim religion, it was a Jewish religion. And so, no, those aren't the solution. That's not the solution. The solution is how we see the other person. Whether we see them as an object of sense gratification, or whether we see them as a devotee of Krishna, or, as the case may be, like Chanaka Pandit said, that one should see every other woman other than his wife as his mother. Matravat paradvaraeshu. That's the quote. And of course, sometimes you have to adjust that a little bit because, let's say, if you're 80 years old and the girl is like 10 years old, it's hard to see her as your mother. But so, in other words, the principle, then you see her as your daughter. Or the women can see the men like their father or like their son. I mean, there's different relationships. One relationship, Prabhupada said, that really we don't want is this thing that they have in Hindu society, which is like sisters. Like in Gujarati, just like you hear the lady's name is always Ben, you know, so-and-so Ben, so-and-so Ben, that means sister. And the men, they're also so-and-so Bai, that means brother. So Prabhupada didn't really like that the, as he could call them, the boys and girls would call each other sister and brother. And even in Hindu society, there's this one ceremony, and I forget the name of the ceremony, where they perform once a year, where they, Rakshabandha it's called. Anyone's heard about that before? No? Anybody? From India? You've heard of Rakshabandha. Where the girl goes up to the boy and ties a little string around his wrist. And Prabhupada said this is a concoction. We should not do this. Complete concoction, because it creates too much of a familiar type of relationship. Because it's easy to jump from sister to girlfriend. So there has to be some way of seeing each other so we don't see each other as objects of sense gratification. I mean, the example I give oftentimes in this regard is the example of Arjuna when he was in the heavenly planets. Arjuna was in the heavenly planets because he was trying to acquire some skills in fighting so that he could defeat the Kurus. And so being up there, he acquired other skills too. He also learned how to dance. He became a good dancer, so later on he could become the dance instructor in the kingdom of Virat, and his name was Brihanala. But what happened there, in addition to all of his learning processes, is... as he was dancing, the celestial girl Urvasi became attracted to him. Now, Urvasi is considered like topmost apsara. The reason she's the topmost apsara is that she was created directly by Krishna. Did you know that? There's the story of Nara and Narayan. They were meditating, and Indra, he tried to disturb their minds. How did he try to disturb their minds? He sent some of his apsaras, Cupid and Spring, and they were all dancing, the birds were chirping, and it was Valentine's Day. And, not really. And then Nara and Narayan, that's Krishna, basically Krishna and Arjuna. Nara means the person, a man, and Narayan, of course, is God. So Krishna and Arjuna, they appear in various places, like Krishna says to Arjuna, many, many times I've appeared, I can remember them all, you can't. And so generally, not generally, but always when Krishna appears, he appears with his friends, his associates, etc., like that. And so Arjuna is one of them. So the demigods, they were trying to lure Narayan, at least Indra was, because Indra gets worried that someone is performing austerities to take over his position. And so he projects his own mentality upon the sages. And so Narayan basically didn't even pay attention to all the dancing girls, you know, you know, like you see in sometimes in these Hindi movies. Oh, another interesting thing, actually about dancing girls, I thought I should mention this, that, you know, you've all heard of Bharatanatyam? So I was wondering how Prabhupada dealt with Bharatanatyam. So I was watching a Prabhupada memory video, and Prabhupada, in front of him, there are some girls performing Bharatanatyam, you know, like that. And I noticed Prabhupada wasn't looking at them. It's interesting, isn't it? You know, Prabhupada really wasn't going, very nice, like that. At the end, he said nice, but he hadn't seen it. So anyway, getting back to the Narayan story. So Narayan weren't even interested in the girls, and they said to Indra, that here, we're going to create some girls for you. And Urvasi came out. And they said, take her back, you know, you can have her. And so she became the best of the apsaras, because she was directly created by Krishna. And so, because she was directly created by Krishna, she was so beautiful. Later on, she had sort of a marriage with this person named Pururava. There's a story in the Bhagavatam, Pururava and Urvasi. She came down, she was cursed for a different reason to come down to the earthly planet, and she had a relationship with Pururava. He was attached to her. Eventually, she went back to the heavenly planets because he didn't fulfill the prenuptial agreement. I mean, the prenuptial agreement was that he would never see her naked, she would never see him naked, and that he would take care of her two pet lambs, and he would always feed her food with ghee rather than anything other food. So anyway, I'm not going to tell that story. It's there in the Bhagavatam. So anyway, so she went back to the heavenly planets, and Pururava was just so upset that he just like wandered all over the earth and found her one day. She agreed to have relationship with him one day a year. That wasn't enough for him. Eventually, the story ends that he performed his sacrifice and went back to the heavenly planets because he was so attached to her. Similar to the story of Agnidra. So in any case, that's Urvasi. So Arjuna was approached by Urvasi. She knocked on his door one night. You know, hello, who's here? Urvasi. And he said, what do you want? And she basically said, you. And he said something to redefine the relationship, in his mind at least. And that protected him, of course, from that. Because she was extremely beautiful, and he was a Kshatriya, and he was handsome, and all those other nice things. So he said to her, Mataji. And that was too much for her. And actually, she was like his mother, because she was the mother, as I mentioned before, she was married to Pururava. So sometimes the dynasty in which Arjuna appeared is called the Puru dynasty. Of course, that's also due to Yayati's son, Puru. But in any case, she was one of the ancestors. Even though she was one of the ancestors because she was in the heavenly planet, she didn't look old. It's not that, like, you go to your great-grandmother and she looks really old. But so Urvasi was the great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother, somewhere like that, of Arjuna. So Arjuna was thinking, you know, she's like our mother. So he addressed her as mother, and of course, that really diffused his whole problem there. But of course, he got a different problem, because she got upset and cursed him. She said, if I can't have you, no one will have you. If I can't have you, you should become a eunuch. And so Arjuna got pretty upset at that point, because kshatriyas are actually very proud of their masculinity. In fact, that's Krishna makes an indirect reference to that in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. You know, that you're not acting like a kshatriya, you know, like a proper person. So there's an indirect reference when Krishna is chastising Arjuna in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, that Arjuna become a eunuch. So Arjuna went to his father Indra, and Indra said, we got to do something about this. So he mitigated the curse. He said, you'll just become a eunuch for 1 year, and that will actually help you when you're actually in exile. So Arjuna didn't understand the whole reason for it, but later on it was very helpful. So in any case, the point I'm making is that to find a relation, a specific relationship, so that there was no more lust in that relationship. So that's really how we can deal with that. Not to see other persons as possible objects of our senses, but to see them in terms of some chaste relationship. And ultimately, when you become a devotee, you know, a pure devotee, you see them in terms of eternal servants of Krishna. I mean, that's how I like to see the ladies, you know, servants of Krishna. One time, several times, Prabhupada actually even wrote letters to devotees calling all the ladies gopis. He wrote letters, it's interesting. He wrote letters to, I think it was in Boston, Sasrup Maharaj, or Sasrup, he was married at that time. He said, how are all the gopis doing? Can you imagine, you know, if I as GBC wrote a letter to Ananta, said, referring to the ladies in the temple, how are all the gopis doing? He would say, what? They're gopis? So, and what about the men? They're all cowherd boys. So in any case, this is how we can deal with this. There's other methods of dealing with the different attractions that arise. Another method, of course, if someone is very attracted to the opposite sex, then there's marriage. And there's the story of Gajendra Mokshana in the eighth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, how Gajendra, he was fighting the crocodile in the water. And because he was fighting the crocodile in the water, he was not able to defeat the crocodile, so because he was an animal of the land. In the same way, devotees have to seek their natural situation in the varnashram culture, that is according to their, you know, the ashram, so that they're able to be stable in Krishna consciousness without succumbing to the allurement of the material energy. The whole point is to be situated so that day after day, in a regulated fashion, we can execute our bhakti. So for some people, that may mean the household life. For other people, that may mean brahmachari life. For other people, sannyas life. Everybody should be engaged according to their nature. So that day after day, we don't want any shooting stars. You know what a shooting star is? A shooting star is like it gets very bright. And we had a lot of that in the movement previously. Very bright. Wow! He must be an incarnation. And then the incarnation went out. So we want people who are, I guess, to use an example that I often use in Krishna consciousness, like the tortoise in that, or the turtle in the story of the turtle and the rabbit, turtle and the hare. You know that story? That the turtle was having a race with a rabbit. I don't know who challenged who. Yeah, I just don't know the beginning. I never learned that part of it. So anyway, so there was a race. And the rabbit said, you know, you stupid tortoise, I'm actually much faster than you. You just crawl along. And I hop. So what happened is they fired the gun at the beginning of the race, you know, one, two, get ready, go, boom. And then the rabbit was going, boom, 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 boom. And then he thought, well, I'm much better than the tortoise, and he went to sleep. And the tortoise just kept going on slow and steady. So the point I'm making is that slow and steady wins the race. We don't want to be passionate over-endeavor in Krishna consciousness. We want to proceed on a slow and steady pace. And in this way, we can reach, it is sure that we will reach the goal. So anyway, these are some of the points I wanted to make about today's verse. Hopefully we won't have to talk about romantic things much longer. I don't know why you picked this part of the Bhagavatam when I came. Anyway, well, tomorrow, actually, the verse is about more about marriage. So tomorrow we can talk about good marriage. And brahmacharis are uninvited to tomorrow's class. You can listen to a tape or MP3 tomorrow morning. So, any questions or comments? Balavan indriya gramo vidvan evihi karshate. You know what that verse is? That the senses are so strong. That was the point. I actually want to make that point earlier. The senses are so strong that even a learned person can have his intelligence stolen away if he is not careful. So it means we should be very, very careful. That means women and men be very careful. Not only with that, but so many things. You know, with the tongue, the belly, the genitals, the mind, the anger, the words. That even if you're super intelligent, you contemplate the senses. Jayato vishyakum sam sangoste shupajayate sangajayate. And then you get, contemplating the senses, you get attached. From attachment comes lust, from lust comes anger, bewilderment, etc. So one has to be very careful in dealing with this material energy of the lords. Money, or any possible thing that may attract us. There's many things that attract us. You know, nice clothes. Everybody has their own attraction, isn't it? Musical instruments. I know one, we used to have one leader in our movement. His attraction was musical instruments, so he had like several hundred guitars. And he had a car collection with like probably about 20 cars, expensive cars. So, I mean, it's not just the man-woman thing. It's just all these different aspects of the material energy that attract us, phantasmagoria. So any, yeah, you had a question? Yes.
My question is, I've been enjoying listening to this various lila from Bhagavatam.
I don't know if this is a lila. I think it's a story told by Bhagavatam. Lila means like a pastime. You know, so this is, I mean, there's many things like the, that are not exactly Leo's, yeah.
So I remember one devotee once doing prasad, morning prasad, he was saying that whenever he, that usually when he listens to these stories, he really feels like they're, sometimes he feels like they're more like stories, that, because they're so far away from our mundane experience of the world.
And not far away from my experience of the world. I've seen this happen every day. I just gave the example of what happened in the temple. This is not far. I mean, this is so easy to believe. No, what happened is so easy to believe. I don't have any trouble believing this. What? But there's so many things you haven't seen. I mean, just like before they invented microscopes. You know what a microscope is? They, you know, if you talked about creatures that look like, you know, demons, you know, microscopic creatures crawling all over your face. Did you know there's these mites? You know what a mite is? A little tiny creature. They're eating your skin continually. It's good. I mean, they help take care of the dead skin. We should like them. I mean, it's a symbiotic relationship. Symbiotic means we feed them and they help us. Like even the sharks, they have these animals that clean their teeth. Did you know that? Like the, I think called pilot fish or something like that. It's a symbiotic relationship. So anyway, so before they invented the microscope, nobody thought that there were these horrible looking creatures all over the place. But when they invented it, then they could see the, I mean, some of them look like monsters out of the, that are on your skin, look like monsters out of the Ramayana or something. Like, I remember when I was young, I got my first microscope and I was going around, you know, taking people's skin and looking at it, saliva and looking at it. It was gross, as they say. So just because we cannot perceive something doesn't mean it doesn't exist. There's so many things we don't perceive. And then we make up, you know, we make up stories about things that we do perceive that aren't real. I mean, for example, during World War II, this is actually interesting. They were fighting in the Pacific. You know, the Japanese and the Americans and the Australians, they were all fighting. So they had to go to certain islands where there were a lot of primitive people on them. And so they landed on these islands. You know, they had to make airstrips on the islands. And when they landed on the islands, the people who lived there, they were given food by the Americans and the Australians and everything like that. They fed them. So these people thought, hey, these are gods that are coming from the heavenly planets, you know, so anyway. And so after they left, after the war, they wanted to continue worshiping the gods. So they made replicas of the airplanes. You've heard about this before? They made replicas of the airplanes as their temples and were worshiping them. So basically, you know, it sounds funny to us, but we're in a real primitive culture too. I mean, you think we're advanced because we have mobile phones, you have a computer, you go on YouTube and post all your fancy videos on YouTube. But, you know, the demigods look at us, and it's just like, you know, these little puny ants. And, you know, it's just insignificant to them. You know, so people ask, well, why don't they come down and introduce themselves? I'd never introduce myself to an ant. Or a cockroach, you know, I just like take them and throw them outside if I see them. So, in other words, there's a lot of things that we haven't seen. Like the scientists used to say that there's no life deep, deep, deep in the sea in these hot water vents, you know, these boiling, but then they found life there. So now the scientists are saying there's no life on the sun. But they haven't been to the sun. If they went to the sun, they'd be cremated, or even half the distance between us and the sun, they'd be cremated. So there's a lot of things we haven't seen. We're basing our conclusions upon indirect evidence. In other words, because we haven't seen something, we see it doesn't exist. Or because we see certain things happen, we draw a general conclusion. This is called induction in philosophy. And, you know, we haven't seen everything. So many things we haven't seen. And they're discovering new species every day, even the scientists, you know. So, this is not so amazing there's demigods. I'd be amazed if there weren't. That's even more amazing. Because that would mean that there's no one in charge. Right? I mean, just like you have electricity here. So, if I say, well, there's no one actually in charge of the electrical powerhouse. I haven't seen them. I don't believe that there's a man doing that, you know, controlling the power. But the evidence that there is the power itself. There has to be some intelligent direction behind it. And ultimately, there's the intelligent direction of Krishna. So, these stories I do not find amazing. I find them pretty common. They're not just stories, they actually happened. I mean, some things are actually stories, like the Paranjana story. in the fourth canto of Bhagavatam. That's obviously a metaphor. You understand the story? Like, he goes to the nine gates of the city, which are his nine apertures in the body. That's obviously a metaphor. But this is, sure, demigods, Lord Brahma. Why not? Do you have some objection? So, any other questions? Comments? Ladies? The Matajis? The Pitajis? Actually, it's a controversy in ISKCON whether the ladies should be called Pravis, which is the feminine of Prabhu. Yes, why not? If you call the men masters, why not call the women a similar thing? Right? Why not? Because everybody, we're servants of everybody. Understand? So, anyway, so if we don't want to get into too much controversy, you know. Matajis, Pitajis. One time, this has happened so much that, this Mataji business in ISKCON, that many times I talk to a married couple, and the man says, I'd like to introduce you to my Mataji. And that's his wife. So he's calling his wife Mataji because it's become so prominent in ISKCON. Here's my Mataji. And I said, oh, that's your mother. And of course, she becomes insulted. And she says, no, I'm his wife. And I said, well, if he's calling you Mataji, you should call him Pitaji, which means father, you know, respected father. So the principle behind the whole thing is to define the relationship so it's not an exploitative, lusty relationship. And if that's the whole principle. So you have to understand the principle behind a particular nomenclature. I mean, just like the sannyasis are supposed to be called Maharaj. Actually, traditionally, that was only meant for kings, because the word Maharaj means, oh, great king. You know, if you were to literally translate it, like when you were talking to me, oh, great king. Well, Raj can also mean passion. Oh, greatly passionate one. It's interesting. So, the principle is it's a respectable title. That's the principle. So we have to see the respectable title. Now, of course, we do use the word Maharaj or Swami. Swami actually means master. Swami, Goswami means master of the senses. So, any other questions? Ladies, don't have any questions? No questions? Yeah. Yeah.
Now, people can ask us, what is the point of this story? What should we learn? Because Brahma is the most intelligent person in the universe, and also we belong to Brahma Gaudiya. So people can, challenge us, what is the point? What should we learn from this?
Well, we can learn that even if one is the most intelligent, one can become bewildered if one is not careful. Secondly, he gave up that particular mentality and later on got his realization. You understand? So we don't criticize a devotee's past. Like to say that, you know, before you joined the Hare Krishna movement, Dharma, you were playing in karaoke club, or, you know, playing in restaurants. You know, maybe you have to do that now. But anyways, so you're playing in restaurants while they were eating meat, or you were doing this or doing that. It's considered offensive to criticize a Vaishnava because of the past, whatever happened in the past. I mean, look at all the Valmiki, the author of the Ramayana. He was a dacoit. Yes, he's the most respected person. Even this person, all the Hindus respect Tulsi Das, who's the author of the Tulsi Das Ramayana, he had some issues before. And so many great personnel, Bilva Mangal Thakur, the author of the Krishna Karnamrita, which Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would read on a regular basis. He had trouble. He was seen prostitute before, right? So you don't consider the past of a great personality. It's extremely offensive. So that's the point. You know, different lessons like that. You know, Lord Brahma had that mentality and actually in some universes, Lord Brahma is the biggest karmi or the biggest jnani rather than the best devotee. Fortunate we have Lord Brahma as a great devotee. I don't think about people's past at all. Even in Christianity, you have Jesus Christ saving that, you know, the prostitute who's being stoned, and he says, "That sin no more." That's all. So don't commit sins anymore. Whatever happened in the past, happened in the past. It's dead. Think about the present and plan for the future. So any other questions? No. I guess everyone's tired after the weekend. Weekend of parties. Ananta, any questions? Yeah.
How does one reconcile the view we usually get from studying in schools that there are impersonal laws in nature? And even Prabhupada sometimes said where there's a law, there's a lawgiver.
That's right, so. Well, this person's applying the law.
So, how does that work, maybe?
Well, did you ever get a ticket driving the car? No. Did you drive a car? No.
Not anymore.
After you got tickets. But just like this person's applying the law. I mean, I just like we were talking to Ananta about the tax situation and everything like that. Are there persons in the tax department? Or just computers. That, you know, you have to supply the information. Gora was working for the last few days to supply the proper information, right? Because this person's there. So the law has to be applied by persons. Probably, I was just listening to some very interesting thing about the law of gravity. Prabhupada was talking about the law of gravity. And he said it's not a law. He said, because sometimes there's a leaf on the tree and the leaf doesn't fall down, so there's certain things that counteract it. In other words, it's not a law that can't be counteracted. It's not an absolute. There is a law of gravity. Prabhupada wasn't saying there isn't gravity, obviously. You know, what goes up, what comes down. But it's not an absolute thing. There's things that can counteract it from time to time. Like airplanes are able to go up, birds are able to go up. But there are physical laws. And as devotees, we should be aware of these physical laws. You know, we are under the jurisdiction of the physical laws, even if you happen to be a great devotee. You're a great devotee. If you jump off this building, you'll still smash all your bones. Of course, if you're Prahlad Maharaj and your father throws you off a cliff, Krishna will save you. But that wasn't defying the laws, that was just Krishna saving him. You understand? So, anyway, there are persons. You never find laws without persons. People giving the law and people enforcing the law. You never find that. And those are the demigods. I think we should end this, the law of prasadam. Okay, all glories to His Divine Grace, Śrīla Prabhupāda, Śrīla Prabhupāda Ki Jaya.